Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And tonight, I'm going to talk a little bit about the expulsion of Germans from Eastern Europe during and after the Second World War. I've talked about this before, years and years ago, but when I was talking about it back then, I wasn't drawing from the work of Keith Lowe, particularly his book Savage Continent, which is an excellent account of the aftermath of the Second World War and the fact that in some places, several years after the end of the war, ethnic cleansing and civil war continued. The idea of wars ending, both the First World War and the Second World War, is particularly kind of Western-centric conceit. After the First World War, as we saw in as we've seen in previous podcasts, conflict continued, and so it did after the Second World War. Again, mainly in Central and Eastern Europe, as finally four multinational empires before the First World War, the Ottoman, the Habsburg, the Hohenzollern, the German, and the Romanov, finally emerged in kind of ethnically homogenous nation-states, albeit mainly behind the Iron Curtain, at the end of the Second World War. And part of that process was the expulsion of national minorities, and no national minority at the end of the Second World War was hated as much as Germans were. So, Keith Lowe writes, beginning his discussion of this at the Tehran conference, he writes, "When the Big Three met at Tehran, they also discussed what would happen to Poland's western border. Churchill and Roosevelt were keen to compensate the Poles for what they would lose to Stalin by giving them parts of Germany and East Prussia instead. Of course, Stalin had demanded that Poland's the Russo-Polish border move westwards." Churchill explained this proposal in a late night session on the first day of the conference. "Poland might move westwards," he said, "like soldiers taking two steps, left close. If Poland trod on some German toes, that could not be helped." To demonstrate what he meant, he placed a row of three matchsticks on the table and moved each of them to the left. In other words, what Stalin took on the east side of Poland, the international community would give back on the western side. So Stalin liked this, obviously. He saw that it could only benefit the Soviet Union. It enabled the Soviet Union to seize eastern Poland, but it also meant that the demarcation line between Moscow and the Allies is shifted westwards, exactly the sort of gambit that he was hoping for. The only nation that's really going to lose territory will be Germany. Germany deserves to be punished as far as Stalin is concerned. And also, it presents the Allied kind of raison d'etre for the war, their kind of defining statement, the Atlantic Charter, to be something of a kind of like a parody. There would be no consultation of the freely expressed wishes of people concerned, which is one of the lines from the Atlantic Charter. It, of course, wouldn't have been possible to consult anyone in Germany, and the term consultation itself is entirely misleading, in that really these consultations would have taken the form of a polite diktat. So, simply telling people their fate as opposed to really asking them what they wanted to do about it. It wasn't considered necessary to wait until the war was ended to agree on the changes to borders. Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden stated to Parliament in justification of these plans, "There are certain parts of the Atlantic Charter which refer in set terms to victor and vanquished alike, but we cannot admit that Germany can claim that any part of the Charter applies to her." Germany, therefore, in the eyes of the British government, and probably the American and Soviet governments as well, existed in a special category all of its own, and that the rules of war now did not apply. Parts of the plans for Germany, for the dismemberment of Germany, for the division of Germany and the occupation of Germany, didn't conform to anything that had particularly been set down in the Atlantic Charter. Ideas such as Henry Morgenthau's Morgenthau plan to, which doesn't come to pass in the end, but to deindustrialise Germany and to return Germany to a kind of like a rural agrarian state, for example, had no basis in the Atlantic Charter, but it was something that was strongly considered anyway. Discussions about the border between Poland and Germany therefore continued at Yalta at the beginning of 1945 and were concluded, as far as they would ever be concluded, at Potsdam the following summer. As a result of these discussions, everything east of the Oder and the Nisa rivers would become Polish, including the ancient German provinces of Pomerania, East Brandenburg, Lower and Upper Silesia, most of East Prussia, and the port of Danzig. All of those areas had been considered German for hundreds of years and were populated almost exclusively by German people, more than 11 million of them, according to the official statistics. So what this meant was there would be an enormous transition of people, an enormous transit of people westwards. There was no way that German people in these new territories would be allowed to remain. There was, in the eyes of the Poles, every justification for doing this, given the mass murder of Poles during the war and the ethnic cleansing of Poles from the Wartegau and East Prussia, and the dumping of Poles into the general government. Churchill put it, "It would be a pity to stuff the Polish goose so full of German food that it got indigestion," which is his way of saying, yes, of course, I fully understand that Germans will have to be removed. There would be, you know, there's no point going and restoring a Polish state if you're simply going to leave German ethnic minorities within it. Perhaps he was suggesting that it was better for the point of a future peace to remove German ethnic minorities so you didn't wind up with a future Sudetenland type incident and further kind of incidences of revanchist German fascism looking to reunite ethnic minorities with the motherland. Perhaps he simply thought that the Germans had been so much trouble in Europe that removing them from Poland and creating homogenous, ethnically homogenous nation states was what was desirable. It's unclear. When the concerns were raised at Yalta about the practicality and the humanity of expelling such large numbers of people from their ancestral homelands, Stalin remarked blandly that most Germans in these regions had already run away from the Red Army, which is entirely true. From 1943 onwards, Germans were fleeing the Baltic states, Poland, and Central and Eastern Europe. But the scope of what was being proposed would be the largest movement of the largest act of ethnic cleansing in human history, far greater than the partition of India 2 years later. Several million Germans, right at the very end of the Second World War, who had fled East Prussia and Danzig and Silesia, actually chose to return there after a temporary, after a short-term period of time in Germany itself. And they thought that it would be possible to go and resume their lives, which shows either a colossal level of naivety or a fundamental misunderstanding about how the world now operated and about what and about the status of Germans outside Germany's borders after the end of the Second World War, and perhaps a degree of denialism. I've spoken before about the amazing chapter in The Third Reich at War by Richard J. Evans, German Moralities, where the Holocaust and the crimes of Germany in Russia and Poland are an open secret. You can know if you want, but nobody wants to know. And many Germans try to kind of downplay and think, well, all sides are at fault and it's all been very unpleasant. And Germans have suffered as well. Our cities have been bombed to the ground. So we could probably go back to our lives in East Prussia or Silesia. You know, the Poles who are there, I'm sure, you know, they'll let bygones be bygones, that kind of thing. So many who were who returned there were conscripted as forced labour in order to pay off German war reparations, or they were removed back westwards, forcibly told to march westwards. So that there is one of the great untold stories of the aftermath of the Second World War is this question of German labour in the Soviet Union, people kidnapped and sent to work there. And the obviously there was the large amounts of German prison labour in the Soviet Union, German army POW labour, but there were significant numbers of civilians as well who simply kind of vanish from history, so making it home in the 1950s. So Kieslow writes, strictly speaking, the Soviets and the Poles were not supposed to start expelling Germans from these areas until after the borders were finalised. Even the provisional borders were not agreed upon until the Potsdam Conference in the summer of 1945. It was expected that the final borders would be drawn up once a peace settlement with Germany was signed by the Allies. But because of the breakdown of relations between the Soviets and the West during the Cold War, and the consequent partition of Germany, such a peace treaty would not actually be signed for another 45 years. In the meantime, the Poles and the Soviets would embark on the programme of expulsions regardless of international agreements. And this became evident when to the American ambassador, Arthur Bliss Lane, when he visited Wrocław in the early autumn.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Of 1945. Rocklove, which had been just a few months before, had been the German city of Breslau, was already in the advanced stages of Polonization, removal of ethnic Germans and the replacement with ethnic Poles. Arthur Bliss Lane wrote, "Germans were being forcibly deported daily to German territory. It was obvious that the Poles did not consider that they were occupying Wrocław temporarily. Subject to the final approval by the peace conference, all German signs were being removed and replaced by those in the Polish language. Poles were being brought into the city from parts of Poland to be to replace repatriated Germans." I mean, one can only imagine the bitterness, the anger, hatred of ethnic Germans that many Poles felt following the devastation of Poland and the staggering mass murder of Poles by the Nazi regime during the war. And perhaps it was utterly inconceivable that a German ethnic minority was ever going to live peaceably or equally alongside the Poles after the war. The expulsions, though, had been ongoing. The letter from Arthur Bliss Lane was dated in the early autumn of 1945, but since May, the evictions had started. Germans had been thrown out of their home. Property had been claimed. These are not always Germans who are complicit in crimes against the Polish people. The majority of Germans who are expelled have either been part of a German minority who have lived in Poland since long before 1918, or they were German settlers who came during the war. I mean, it's arguable that there is a great deal of complicity even from civilian settlers on occupied land, which has been occupied at the expense and the often the bloodshed of the indigenous Polish people. However, the expulsions are of civilian non-combatants. So it raises all sorts of moral questions of its own. It was not only the Red Army that raped and robbed Germans with abandon, but Poles too, writes Keith Lowe. In their cities, such as Stettin, Danzig, and other centres of German populations, the Germans were headed into ghettos, partly so that the Poles could very quickly take over German properties without really much hassle, but also to keep the Germans safe from the Polish population at large. It was for their own protection. Camps were set up for Germans, concentration camps in essence, often to use them as labour or to keep them in one place before they could be officially deported. Of course, they would be stripped of any wealth, belongings and property whilst they were incarcerated. Some Poles became impatient, and these were ordinary civilians who were not keen to wait around for official permission to deport. They became angry at the thought of Germans being in their community. And they began to take it upon themselves in a sort of vigilante justice style, which you find, of course, all over Europe. from Greece to France to Norway to the Netherlands. They would round up Germans and drive them over the border. In the Polish records show that in the last 2 weeks of June 1945 alone, 274,206 Germans were unlawfully deported across the Oder River into Germany. And they were perhaps the ones that would have been considerable violence, and there were no doubt fatalities along the way, but things were considerably worse for German civilians who were rounded up or deported later on. This is not unique to Poland. In the spring and summer of 1945, the Czechs were busy driving hundreds of thousands of Sudeten Germans over their borders in a similar frenzied way. The anger that the Poles and the Czechs feel towards the Germans is deeply, deeply tragic, because prior to Hitler's annexation of the Sudetenland, prior to Hitler's invasion of Poland, the status of Germans in these communities was entirely stable. I mean, there were German Nazis who caused immense amounts of trouble in the Sudetenland, but still, the Czechoslovakia was still a successful multi-ethnic state where the rights of Czechs, Slovaks, Germans, and other East European ethnic minorities were represented, were protected and enshrined in the Czech constitution. So the racial supremacy that Hitler put at the heart of Nazism, the idea that Germans were ethnically superior and could not be ruled over by inferior Slavs, leads, ironically, at the failure of Hitler's war to the final expulsion of Germans from territories that were considered once to be ethnically German. The expulsions in 1945 were, once again, not events that were organised by the central authorities, but they were really the product of local ethnic hatreds. The urgency that characterised the expulsions, writes Kieslow, implies that the Poles and the Czechs alike were eager to get rid of the German minorities before any outside agency stepped in to stop them doing so. So there was a kind of a race on to expel. So it was for this reason that the Big Three at Yalta felt it was necessary to make a formal declaration on the way that the transfer of Germans was to be carried out. They thought, well, it's happening anyway, so let's make sure that it happens in a particular way. And so the Poles, the Czechs and the Hungarians were told that they could remove Germans in an orderly and humane manner. Of course, the removals were done with a great deal of brutality, and the fact of the matter was that at the end of the war, where the Soviets had lost 27 million war dead, and the British and the Americans were weary of the conflict and wanted it to end, and were not concerned with the affairs of Eastern Europe, the fate of Germans, who had seemingly, in the eyes of many British and Americans, caused the world such an immense amount of trouble, could be quickly dispensed with and hands could be washed. So Kieslow writes, it was not only the brutal way that these people were being expelled that was the problem. It was also the inability of the Allies within Germany to cope with the huge influx of refugees. They needed time to organise a system for integrating these newcomers and dispersing them with equitably throughout the different zones of Germany. Although this declaration managed to slow the transfer of Germans, it signally failed to bring it to a halt. The Poles refused to stop expelling Germans from Silesia and Stettin. Furthermore, it is recognition that the expulsions would have to be undertaken. The Potsdam Declaration provided all the countries involved with an official endorsement for their actions, if not immediately, then at least in the very near future. As a consequence, the expulsion of Germans from across Europe would not be confined to a spontaneous but temporary phenomenon that might fizzle out over time. It now had the potential to become an official, permanent and total removal of German men, women and children from every other corner of Europe. It was for this reason that Anno Herr McCormick of the New York Times called it the most inhuman decision ever made by governments dedicated to the defence of human rights. So the actual kind of human cost of this is quite staggering, and the violence that German ethnic people experienced as they were deported mirrored some of the great acts of brutality that the Nazis and the Wehrmacht had inflicted on peoples across Europe, not just the Jews, but countless others. So when we dive back into this, we're probably going to look at the human realities of these expulsions. Okay, so let's finish there. And I'm going to be adding more things now to the podcast in the next few days, because there's the time and the scope to really kind of develop the podcast rather a lot. So there'll be plenty more content coming your way. Just want to say a huge thanks to Alvaro, a very good friend of the Explaining History podcast and a long-time listener, who's currently helping to develop and relaunch the Explaining History website, which is going to be a great resource for all of you guys in 2021. It's going to keep the various bloggings I've done, the podcast and the video in one handy portal, and other things that might develop on there too. So huge thanks there. And as ever, we sustain ourselves through a little bit of advertising revenue, but also the kindness of our patrons. Last year, I was kind of a bit of a Patreon write-off for me because of the effects of the long COVID that myself and my wife were in recovery from, so we were kind of wiped out for the whole year. But we're kind of back on it this year. I'm kind of back on it, and I'll be adding new content to the Patreon. So if you want Patreon exclusive content, check it out, and it'll be on there soon. And thanks to all our patrons for being so generous and keeping the podcast going and having belief in what we're doing. Thanks very much, everybody. Take good care. All the best. Bye-bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.